Good morning, counsel. This case, the first case on the oral argument calendar of the en banc court on January 5th is Endo Health Solutions, Inc. versus District Court, Real Party in Interest, City of Reno, case number 81121. I'd like to acknowledge and welcome newly sworn in Justice Douglas Herndon. From a historical standpoint, this will be the justice's first oral argument as a justice on the court.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Chief Justice Hardesty, I apologize.
Okay, are counsel ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
We are, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Polsenberg or Ms. Lundball, if you're ready to proceed, let's get started.
May it please the court, my name is Pat Lundball, and I present on behalf of all petitioners who manufacture and distribute lawful FDA-approved prescription medications to licensed physicians and pharmacies throughout our nation, including the state of Nevada. I intend to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Nevada has 16 counties and 19 incorporated municipalities or cities. At present, of those 35 counties and cities, 24 have brought separate lawsuits in separate jurisdictions. All lawsuits, with minor exception, have been filed against these petitioners or their corporate affiliates. All of these separate lawsuits make the exact same material allegations concerning the marketing and distribution of opioid prescription medications. All suits seek the exact same prospective and injunctive and declaratory and punitive and medical monitoring relief and the exact same type of damages. In fact, the prayers for relief on 21 of those lawsuits are verbatim. While the language on three of them are different, they ask for the same essential relief. And that relief is not limited to compensatory damages. Each may require a separate trial. Given the separateness of each lawsuit, there's a substantial risk of disparate results. Disparate results may lead to a patchwork of relief or no relief for Nevadans. Consider, what if Nye County is successful, but the city of Las Vegas is not? All of these lawsuits seek statewide injunctive relief to stop the promotion and marketing of opioids in Nevada. What if the city of Reno loses, but the city of Wendover prevails? Whose injunction is going to apply? Moreover, why do the cities and counties get multiple opportunities to request the same relief? With 24 separate lawsuits, the risk of disparate results is real. All of these separate lawsuits have been filed by a private law firm, and all 24 echo the material allegations found in the complaint filed by the state of Nevada, also against these petitioners, and also filed by this same private law firm. The single issue before this court does not address the legal liability of any of these petitioners. Those are issues for another day. Instead, this writ examines whether Nevada law grants the city of Reno, as a political subdivision of the state of Nevada, the power to bring its lawsuit. The answer to that question requires a straightforward application of the plain meaning of a simple language of a statute that was enacted by our legislature in 2015. The statute is found in Chapter 268. It is specific to cities. It has a counterpart specific to counties, and that's found in Chapter 244. Rarely has our legislature been given a more clear roadmap for this court to follow. And rarely has a litigant, like the city of Reno, made this court's job easier in applying that statute, given the allegations found within the four corners of the city's complaint. The analysis under the statute is pretty simple. Has Nevada's legislature granted an express or an implied power to the city of Reno to file the lawsuit at issue? If the answer to that is no, the second question is, does the filing of the lawsuit fit the single exception found within the statute for a very specifically and very uniquely defined matter of local concern? And if the answer to that question is no, then the city did not have the power to file its lawsuit, and it must be dismissed as ultra-virus. Let me turn to the details of the statute, but even those details aren't particularly difficult. As to the legislature's specific roadmap, NRS 268.001 subsection 3 is the starting point. That starting point asks this court to first determine whether Nevada's constitution or Nevada's legislature expressly granted power to the city of Reno to file its lawsuit. We pointed out in our petition that there was no express grant of power. There's nothing within Nevada's constitution, the city's charter, or any statute that's been enacted by our legislature that expressly granted power to the city to file its lawsuit advancing the claims that it did. In its answering brief, the city of Reno did not contend that they possessed any express power. Chapter 268 also speaks to implied powers, but those powers are only to be found as necessary to protect or further an express power. In other words, implied powers are derivative of express powers. Without an express power,
Ms. Lindblom, let me ask you a quick question before we move forward. Can you point to any case law from any jurisdiction that suggests Dillon's rule is limits a city's ability to sue for damages, as opposed to limiting a city's ability to pass law or an ordinance or a legislative function? Do you have any case from anywhere where Dillon's rule has been implied to prohibit a city from suing or being sued?
In essence, what you're getting to is whether or not that there's a lawsuit exception then to Dillon's rule found within the statute.
Or whether Dillon's rule even applies to suing or being sued.
Understood, Your Honor. And that's one of the things that the city contends and the district court agreed that somehow that there was this lawsuit exception. Five reasons why, in fact, that the lawsuit exception does not exist. If you look at the controlling text of the statute, case law from this court, case law from other jurisdictions, the city's concession that it made below that it could not accomplish via ordinance what it is seeking to accomplish via its lawsuit, and a pretty real and practical application. First, if you turn to 268.001, subsection 3, it expressly states that cities possess and may exercise only the following powers and no others. The language "and no others" clearly encompasses making a decision and acting on a decision to litigate. There's no general exception in the statute for litigating. When you look at other statutes, Your Honor, that specifically define a city's power, you find very specific express grants of power to litigate. It's in the form of hospital liens or inmate reimbursement. Those express grants of powers also include certain procedural requirements. If there was some type of a general lawsuit exception to Dillon's rule or to the statute, then those specific grants of power would be superfluous. And this court has been loath to find language within statutes to be superfluous, especially when in fact that you find express language to the contrary. Next, when you look at this court's decision in Rona, it made clear that all acts beyond the scope of the powers granted are void. Surely all acts by a city must include making a decision to litigate and then acting on that decision.
Ms. Lundell, what about
specifically for?
Excuse me. Ms. Lundell,
yes.
What about NRS 268.4124 regarding abatement of chronic nuisances and the civil penalties for failure to abate with the recovery of money expended by the city? How do you distinguish that particular specialized statute from perhaps what plaintiff is trying to allege in the First Amendment complaint here with the nuisance.
One of the things, Your Honor, if you look at that statute as well, it has certain procedural requirements. None of those procedural requirements were met. And in fact, that the city acknowledged that it was not seeking as far as damages pursuant to that particular statute. It acknowledged that it had no express power then that was set forth within any statute or its charter. But to going back to Justice Stiglitz's question, one of the things that I think you can look at in the converse, and that is this, that there is no case law that can be that was brought by the city of Reno that is that specifically permitted litigation as some type of an exception then to the application of Dillon's rule. In contrast, the highest courts in Colorado and in Missouri, and we brought you those cases, applied Dillon's rule to bar lawsuits then as being ultra-virus. We also brought you case law then from the United States Supreme Court and throughout the U.S. identifying that there's no real meaningful difference between regulation through litigation or regulation through ordinance or legislation. On the record, the city admitted that it could not seek via ordinance the same relief that it is seeking in this litigation. But lastly, let's be practical. The city engaged in many acts of governance or decision-making before it chose to litigate. The city had to agendize and discuss publicly whether or not it was going to litigate. It heard presentation on that item. City councilmen voted on that agenda item. City councilmen directed the private law firm to act on those on its behalf. Each one of those acts was an act of governance. And the statute that this court is being asked to apply is founded upon Dillon's rule, and it forbids any act or exercise of power that's not affirmatively granted by the legislature.
But, Ms. Lindvall, how is the city initiating a tort lawsuit an exercise of governmental power? Once the city files a lawsuit, it's a litigant like any other person. It's bringing a lawsuit pursuant to the same laws that govern everyone. If the court hears a case on its merits, it'll treat Reno as it would any private litigant. If Reno wins, then the court will exercise coercive power to enforce the law, not Reno. So how is that, if you can just work with my premise there, how do you square that with?
How I square that, Your Honor, I guess is with an example. Right now, as far as the city is contending that somehow that because it fits within the health and safety and the welfare then of either its city residents or the county residents, that they have the power then by which to protect that. We are now still in a pandemic. Let's say that the city council chose to bring a lawsuit that said, I want a declaration from the court that says my stores can open in my jurisdiction and that I don't have to follow any governor's mandate.
Right.
Or let's say that it wants to bring some type of litigation in that regard. Those types of acts are acts of governance. And the statute is clear that any act that is not expressly or impliedly delegated to the city is not permitted unless it falls within a matter of local concern. And the definition of a matter of...
I apologize, Ms. Lindvall. Aren't the claims that are being asserted, the tort claims that are being asserted, generally applicable common law claims that are not unique to a city as a litigant? Like, aren't they just seeking to apply state common law that governs different kinds of tort claims, fraud, or you know, whatever the claims are that they've asserted? So aren't they just applying generally applicable law?
Respectfully, Your Honor, they are not. When you look at the prayers for relief, what you'll see is this. They are asking for injunctive, prospective, declaratory relief, medical monitoring, punitive damages, statewide. Each one of these lawsuits goes beyond the four corners of its geographic location and then impacts then residents in other counties and in other cities. And the fact that it does do that demonstrates that they are not seeking to address a matter of local concern. And therefore, the issue does not singularly affect either the city of Reno or any of the other individual counties or any of the other cities.
Ms. Lundwell,
without an express power.
Ms. Lundwell, this is Justice Hardesty. On the issue of local concern, I wanted to ask you, and I'll ask Mr. Eglut the same. It does not appear from the judge's order that the judge applied the definition, statutory definition, governing a matter of local concern, but rather substituted a health safety explanation for what is a local concern. Could you comment on that and its consequence if that's the case?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the things that findings that were made by the district court expressly found that, in fact, that the city's complaint sought to impact others beyond its four corners, and it also recognized that the conduct that was at issue was substantially regulated by federal agencies. Those are the two definitions that fit within a matter of local concern. Once those findings were made, it put it outside of a matter of local concern. The subset then to that section, which is NRS 268.003, makes clear that the examples in the subset cannot expand or change the specific definition that is found under the first clause then of that particular statute. And therefore, we believe that that was error. Without an express or an implied power or a matter of local concern power, the city was without power to litigate. And therefore, we would ask this court to find its lawsuit then as ultra-virus and dismiss.
I'd like to circle back. I'll give you some additional time because we've asked you some questions and we'll do the same for Mr. Eglut. But I'd like to circle back to some questions that Justice Stiglitz asked, and it relates to subsection 1A of the statute regarding express powers. I will be frank to say that in reading the statute, it seemed to me of interest to note that the preface goes into whether or not the powers are expressed either by the Constitution, the statute, or city charter. In looking at, I'm trying to clarify the argument here. Is it your position that the city charter does not contain any express delegation of powers to sue, or is it your argument that the city of Reno didn't argue that, or both, or something else?
It's both, Your Honor. There was no express power that was articulated by the city of Reno in its complaint. As when you look at the Reno City Charter, what you're referring to is there's a general provision that identifies the capacity of a city, an incorporated municipality, or a county then to sue or to be sued.
Right.
That language then has been specifically defined by other jurisdictions, particularly Colorado and Missouri then, as not being a specific identification of a power, but it's akin to a capacity argument. And therefore, when you look at the specific express authorizations, examples of which that we brought to you in our reply brief, that expressly identify when a city has the power to litigate. Our legislature has been quite clear when they have that power, and there is no articulated specific power to bring the lawsuits that are at issue here. And I use this as an example in the sense of the inmate litigation, the hospital liens. There are express direct statutes on point identifying that a city, if damaged, may seek compensatory damages for that kind of relief. It also has certain procedural requirements expressed within there. If the city charter were enough, which we submit that it is not. And because it just simply lays out a general capacity argument, then you would find those express grants of power to litigate as nothing but superfluous. That the legislature is somehow wasting its time then and wasting its energy enacting statutes that identify express powers if in fact that it already had those powers. We submit that it is not.
I'm sorry for interrupting you, Ms. Lundvall, but I wanted to cover one more question in this area. Under subsection 3B, I understand your argument that the charter language, sue or be sued, is characterized in some jurisdictions and cases as capacity arguments. But from that language, what's your position with respect to whether subsection 3B implied powers can nevertheless be drawn from that language in the statute? And did the city of Reno make that argument in this case?
Number one, that they had not made that argument in this case. In fact, that they were entirely silent on any type of an express power. Their only argument on an implied power was somehow that it was derivative of health, safety, and welfare. And so let me see if I can address then the court's question. Once again, if you look at the city's charter, it identifies different capacities. In other words, trying to define what the capacities are. It is not specific as to being able to bring certain litigation. And if you looked at an example, I go back to the same example that I used with Justice Stiglitz. If in fact that cities or counties, under its own statutes then, had the power to litigate, then it would have had powers by which to litigate, to seek declaratory relief, suggesting that somehow that they could deviate then from either the state's or the nation's position on our COVID pandemic issues. And the issue, I think, demonstrates then how disparate and how erratic and how harmful that type of issue is. Moreover, when you look at then the complaints that have been brought, they are duplicative then of the complaint that was brought by the state of Nevada. And the state of Nevada complaint is no different than every other instance where our state has thought that all Nevadans deserve some form of compensation for allegedly wrongful conduct. And the example that I give for that is the most recent Volkswagen case that the state joined in on behalf of all Nevadans, and for which then that it received certain funds, and it allowed compensation then to be made then to cities and states who made application against that fund. And so that is the classic way for which litigation to be advanced, as has been empowered then pursuant to statute. Okay. And because the city of Reno did not have the power, that's why we submit that this lawsuit then is ultra-virus.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lundvall. Given the questions that we've asked and the interactions, I'll provide you with 8 minutes of rebuttal time. We'll add 8 minutes to Mr. Eglett's argument. Mr. Eglett, are you ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Robert Eglett, and I have the privilege of representing the city of Reno. Petitioners are asking this court to interpret, or more accurately, expand Dillon's rule in a way that no court in the country has ever done in the 150 years since Dillon's rule was created. There are thousands of local government opiate suits being pursued across the country, and petitioners can cite to no other court in America that has dismissed a local government's opiate case based upon Dillon's rule. Dillon's rule was not created, nor has it ever been interpreted, to deny a local government's ability to sue to recover damages caused to that local government by third parties. And every case petitioners cite for their argument that Dillon's rule prevents local governments from suing to recover damages, either one, doesn't address or even mention Dillon's rule, two, involves a local government's board suing a state agency where the state laws establish that the board did not have standing to sue the state agency, not that Dillon's rule precluded the local government from suing for damages, or three, involved a local government passing a regulation which it had no power to do under Dillon's rule and either sued or countersued to enforce the invalid regulation, and the case was dismissed because the regulation itself was invalid and thus unenforceable, not that Dillon's rule was expanded or interpreted to deny a local government from suing for damages, which makes sense because the ability to sue for damages is not now and never has been limited by Dillon's rule. It is not a lawsuit exception to Dillon's rule, as petitioners claim, because there has never been a lawsuit inclusion in Dillon's rule. And looking through the history of the rule and the reasons for its creation, it was not intended to stop a local government from suing to recover damages. Dillon's rule was enacted in 1870 to stop local governments from creating ordinances, regulations, laws, taxes, and fees that would infringe upon the state, therefore costing the state and taxpayers money. So there is a great deal of information available regarding the reason the rule was created, how the rule has evolved since its creation, and how it has been applied by the courts nationwide. And every article and every case addressing Dillon's rule discusses local government's creation and enforcement of regulations, taxes, fees, and ordinances, not their ability to sue damages. Many states have adopted Dillon's rule, but as time has gone by and the country has changed, so has the rule. The Hutchinson case from Utah discusses the change and provides this court with guidance on how to proceed here. In Hutchinson, the Utah Supreme Court walked through the history of Dillon's rule and how the strict construction of the rule has become problematic as governments changed. The court ruled that local governments need to be able to take actions necessary to address local concerns. And so long as local governments are not interfering with state or federal law or not engaging in conduct explicitly prohibited by statute, courts should not interfere. The Hutchinson Court also discussed the general welfare clause present in Utah statute. Reno's charter, which was approved by the Nevada legislature in 1971, includes a similar general welfare clause. Reno's charter was created to secure and preserve the health, safety, general welfare, and property of the residents of the city. Reno's charter also includes language explicitly stating that it is to be liberally construed, and Nevada's constitution empowers cities to create charters for the city's own government. In Hutchinson, the court stated that there was an increasing judicial inclination under a general welfare clause to grant municipal authorities wider discretion in a reasonable and non-discriminatory exercise of the police power in the public interest. And just like in Hutchinson, Nevada's constitution grants cities the power to create charters or city governance, and where the state has granted such a general welfare powers, as Nevada did when the legislature approved Reno's charter, those local governments have authority independent of and in addition to any specific powers granted by the statute, so long as the city's actions are appropriately related to the general welfare, which includes public safety and health. Nevada's legislature recognized the problems with the strict application of Dillon's rule when it enacted NRS 68001, specifically stating that the strict application of the rule is unnecessarily restrictive. The legislature drafted a statute that reverses the rebuttable presumption from the original Dillon's rule. Now, if there is any fair or reasonable doubt concerning the existence of a city's power to address a matter of local concern, it must be presumed that the city has the power unless the presumption can be rebutted by evidence of a contrary intent by the legislature. And NRS 268-00353 sets out an enumerated list of five things that a city government shall not do. The ability to bring a lawsuit is not included in this list. Reno has not enacted an ordinance, imposed a fine, or otherwise created regulations related to opiate marketing, sales, and distribution within the city. It sued to recover the cost it has incurred as a result of the epidemic. This lawsuit is not an attempt to create a regulation. A civil lawsuit in which a city seeks damages of a court causes action is not the equivalent of enacting an ordinance or regulation. It is a lawsuit intended to reimburse the city for the damages caused by the defendants. Additionally,
Mr. Eglett, I apologize. Yes. Mr. Eglett, my question is, can you just clarify the nature of the damages that Reno is seeking to recover in the case? Like, is it actual damage to the city itself, damage to its residents, and also clarify the injunctive relief you're seeking? Please.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So the damages that Reno is seeking to recover is to recover damages it and its agencies have incurred as a result of the opiate epidemic, and an injunction to prevent petitioners from engaging in their negligent and wrongful marketing activities within the city of Reno under current Nevada law. It is not intended to limit any of petitioners' legal activities within the city. And the injunctive relief is requested by this lawsuit is simply asking the petitioners be required to follow existing Nevada law. It is not an attempt to enforce a Reno-specific or Reno-created law, and thus is neither making regulation nor regulating petitioners' businesses. And the damages are basically damages to their agencies, like their court services, their social services, their hospital services, their coroner and medical examiner services, all the different services that cities provide there, and some cities provide different types of services, but all the cities services that their cities provide their residents, and in Reno's case includes human services, social services, court services, law enforcement services, coroner and medical examiner, and health services in the city, which have all been impacted by the epidemic. These damages are unique to Reno and cannot be recovered by any other city government.
Thank you.
So additionally, neither the Premium Standard Farms case nor Board of Commissioners v. Love support petitioners' position here. Premium Standard Farms involves a township passing a regulation it had no power to do under Dillon's rule, and countersued to enforce the regulations as well as for public nuisance. The case was dismissed because the regulation itself was unenforceable, not because the township cannot file any lawsuit. Additionally, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled that the township's nuisance claim could not be maintained because Missouri's statute specifically outlined which governmental entities can sue for public nuisance and did not include townships. So the township would not have been able to file a nuisance cause of action with or without a discussion of Dillon's rule. The decision does not support a finding that a local government is prevented from filing any lawsuit to recover damages under Dillon's rule. And in Love, the court looked at a county board's ability to challenge the decision of a state tax commission in the courts. So having nothing to do with Dillon's rule, had to do with the interpretation of the state statutes and the fact that the county board and members of the county board didn't have standing to sue and they didn't exhaust their remedies before taking the loss. Even if they had standing, they didn't exhaust their remedies before seeking an appeal.
So Mr. Eglett, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you brought up Premium Standard Farms, and that did involve a nuisance cause of action. How do you distinguish in this case? The legislature did give an express grant of the city to prosecute nuisance actions. I asked the same thing of Ms. Lundvall under NRS 268-4124. And under that, it's an abatement of a chronic nuisance. There are specific steps that must be taken as far as the city attorney and the municipal courts and what can be recovered. That's a specific statute on nuisance. Here in your complaint, First Amendment complaint, you talk about absolute nuisance and qualified nuisance, these things that are not listed in the statute. How do you distinguish that?
The power is to
the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. The powers to enact ordinances to address nuisances are in addition to the power to enforce existing state law. Those power evidence a legislative intent to give local governments broad powers to address nuisances. And compared to NRS 268.418, which confirms that state control over regulation of firearms declares exclusive state jurisdiction, there is no similar provision related to nuisances or other common law claims, such as negligence. And the other provisions in NRS 268 support our argument. It has never been disputed that a city has the power to file lawsuits regarding violations of state law committed within the city. Dillon's rule only applies when a city tries to enact and enforce its own ordinances and regulations without authority. The provisions cited by petitioners give legislative authority to cities to enact additional ordinances that the cities can enact and enforce on their own, even if those ordinances differ from city to city. These provisions do not take any away or eliminate a city's underlying ability to sue for violation of existing state law. So neither the Premium Farms nor the Love case involves local government's ability to sue to recover damages caused by third parties.
Mr. Eglin, this is Justice Hardesty. If I could follow up, I appreciate your explanation for Justice Silver's question, but that explanation seems to me to render the statute she cited superfluous.
Well, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. We just don't agree with that it makes the statute superfluous. Because it says, in addition to, the powers to enact ordinances to address nuisances are in addition to the power to enforce existing state law, Your Honor.
Okay.
The Renau case relied upon by the petitioners was not only decided 78 years before the creation of NRS 268.001, it also does not discuss anywhere in the opinion the power of a city to file a lawsuit. This court should decline to expand Dillon's rule as requested by petitioners, as it is inconsistent with the history of the rule and contradictory to Nevada's codification of the rule. But even if Dillon's rule could be interpreted to deny a city's ability to sue, which it can't without significantly expanding the rule in a way that has never been done, Reno's lawsuit meets the definition of local concern, and thus it is within the city's power to pursue the claims against petitioners. The legislature took a rare step in 2015 by not only codifying the modified Dillon's rule, but also including its reasoning for doing so within the statute. The legislature clearly intended to expand the powers of city governments to address matters of local concern and forward the effective operation of city government. In fact, NRS 268.003 supports Reno's ability to continue with this lawsuit. It specifically defines local concern as including without limitation matters involving public health, safety, welfare, and nuisances in the city, which undeniably includes the opiate epidemic.
Mr. Eglin, if I could interrupt you there, I had raised this question with Ms. Lundvall. It does not appear, and I may be mistaken, but it does not appear that the district court used that statutory definition in its analysis. What's your view on that?
Well, the district court judge ruled and said that Dillon's rule does not apply if that's the case, you don't need to look at local concern. But if the district court judge said consider local concern, he found public health is a local concern, specifically is what he found, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, NRS 268. 0.003 supports Reno's ability to continue with this lawsuit. It specifically defines local concern as including without limitations matters involving public health, safety, welfare, and nuisances in the city, which undeniably, as I said, includes the opiate epidemic. And not only the, sorry, just a second.
Before you continue on local concern, I just want to go back to something Ms. Lundvall was referring to. Why doesn't Section 1.020 of the City Charter, which says may sue and be sued in all courts, constitute an express grant of power? Why isn't this a 3A situation instead of even going into local concern? I appreciate there might be the Missouri case we talked about. Why isn't that an express grant?
I believe it is an express grant, Your Honor, and that's one of the reasons, and if I didn't articulate that well enough, I apologize. The first half of my argument here was Dillon's rule just doesn't apply here, period. It's never applied. In 150 years of the rule, there has never been a case, never, or even an article that says a local government cannot sue for damages it has incurred from a third party.
Mr. Eglin, did you argue that to the district court?
It was certainly part of our briefing, Your Honor. I believe it was part of the argument. You know, a lot of times the arguments, we respond to what the arguments are on the other side. And I don't believe that the defendants have ever spent much time on that argument in the courts below, because they just made the assumption. They made the assumption that it applied and then just went right to the whether it's a matter of local concern. Well, it doesn't apply, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. If that's true, what cases from Nevada or anywhere show that a city has sued for nuisance and negligence?
Your Honor, I mean, I don't have a list of all the cases, but nuisance law has been part of the American jurisprudence, part of our American jurisprudence since our country has been around.
Well, Mr. Eglin, I was a municipal court judge, and I presided over hundreds of nuisance cases, and that's why I keep going back to
because I
did preside over nuisance cases. So I'm asking you, as a result of that, what can you point to any case that goes back to common law negligence or common law nuisance that the city has prosecuted?
The city of Reno
or city of Las Vegas?
We're in the same state. Yes, I don't have those cases off the top of my head. All I would say is there's just no doubt that local governments have been allowed to pursue nuisance claims in the United States unabated or since our country has been around. And if there hasn't been at least hundreds, there's been thousands of nuisance claims across the country. And so if one of these nuisance claims had been dismissed based on Dillon's rule, defense counsel would have found that case. There is no case where that's ever happened, Your Honor. Not only does NRS 268 focus on a city's ability to address matters of local concern, so does the Reno Charter, which is to be liberally construed. The charter approved by the Nevada legislature states that it was created to preserve the health and safety of the residents and that it must not be construed to limit the general powers necessary for Reno to carry out the purposes of the charter. Damages Reno has incurred because of the opiate epidemic are matters of local concern because they impact only Reno, only Reno's residents, only Reno's programs, and only the functionality of Reno. They are the city's damages and the city's alone. Now, of course, the opiate epidemic has impacted the entire nation. But the impact of the opiate epidemic in other cities, counties, and states is not the same as the impact on Reno. As to the state, the damages it seeks are entirely different than those Reno is claiming. The state's damages are forward-looking abatement damages and damages only available to the state, such as Medicaid reimbursement and the Deceptive Claims Practices Act. Reno's lawsuit does not interfere with or contradict the state's lawsuit. And General Ford has spoken in favor of local government's ability to pursue their distinct damages in separate lawsuits. But while the opiate epidemic is nationwide, the damages suffered by each jurisdiction are unique. The existence of other lawsuits should not prevent Reno from seeking to recover its unique damages. Reno's claims do not fall into any areas excluded from matters of local concern within NRS 268. Reno's requested damages are unique to Reno and cannot be addressed through uniformity in regulation or damages across the state.
Mr. Eglin?
The city is Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Justice Hardesty. I appreciate your argument about cabining the damages the way you've articulated. What concerns me, and it relates to a question earlier asked by Justice Kadish, is the request for injunctive relief. In other contexts, we have had arguments involving whether or not these are preempted or whether even the award of damages can be preempted by federal law relating to the labeling or the governance of drug distributions. And so I don't know whether that was vetted very well in the district court. I'm not criticizing counsel. I'm just saying in the order disposing of this issue. But it does seem like injunctive relief could be problematic, and it could vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, where setting aside the preemption questions could, among various state courts, hearing these cases have varying outcomes in their injunctive relief that they order. Are the complaints cabined in the same way you attempt to cabin the damages for an injunctive relief?
Well, it's a long question, and let me take it in parts, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm, sure.
First, the federal regulations do not encompass the areas addressed in Reno's complaint. And if they did, petitioners surely would have moved to dismiss based on federal preemption, which they did not. The city's complaint includes state tort causes of action against petitioners based upon petitioners' wrongdoing in marketing opiates and filling suspicious orders, and not issues with labeling or product defect. Further, petitioners claim that Reno's lawsuit is too entangled with federal regulations to be a matter of local concern is belied by the federal court remanding this case within 48 hours of oral argument after petitioners had removed the case based upon their claim that Reno raised federal questions in their complaint. The injunctive relief is requesting by way of this lawsuit is simply asking the petitioners be required to follow already existing law. It is not an attempt to enforce a Reno-specific or Reno-created law, and thus is neither making regulation nor regulating petitioners' business activities. And it is always possible for different courts and different juries to reach different conclusions. However, I want to make clear that the injunctive relief sought here only requires petitioners to comply with Nevada law. It is not a case where Reno is trying to impose its own local laws on petitioners, and I would also note that petitioners have not demonstrated how the injunctive relief sought in this case would necessarily conflict with the state or federal. And also, you know, petitioners are aware that the city is not seeking, they're aware of this, that the city is not seeking injunctive relief as petitioners' actions in the entire state, nor is any other jurisdiction, because this issue arose at oral argument on the motions to dismiss, and beginning at line 24 of petitioner's appendix 02731 through line 6 of petitioner's appendix 02372, I explained to the court that it should read that any injunction relief is limited to petitioner's actions in Reno, Your Honor. So the city is not regulating business activity or infringing upon federal opiate regulation, and there is no state statute preventing Reno's lawsuit. Reno's lawsuit addresses matters of local concern, and thus there is a presumption in favor of Reno's ability to file its lawsuit. And petitioners have offered no evidence of a contrary legislative intent to rebut the presumption. Therefore, this court should not expand Dillon's rule to deny a local government the ability to sue for damages, because petitioners have not provided you with any case where local government was blocked from suing a third party under similar facts. And with the army of qualified lawyers on the other side, if such a case existed, they would have found it. So even if this court is inclined to expand Dillon's rule, which it should not, particularly considering the legislature in 2015 clearly indicated in the statute and the legislative history that they were not making Dillon's rule more expansive, but contracting it and making it less restrictive because it was too restrictive. Rito's allegations fall within the definition of matter of local concern, and the petition should be denied and the decision of the district court affirmed. Thank you for your time this morning, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Eglett. Do the justices have any additional questions for Mr. Eglett?
No, sir.
All right. Ms. Lundvall, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope to make four quick points. The first point I want to address that was made by counsel for the city of Reno addressed the question that was posed by Justice Cage and that was echoed then by Chief Justice then Hardesty. It dealt with the relief that was being sought. You have before you the prayers for relief from the city of Reno case, and you also have before you multiple prayers for relief from the other city and county cases that have been brought. In addition, you have the prayer for relief in the record before you, as well as the entirety of the complaint that was brought by the state of Nevada. First and foremost, the injunctive relief, the medical monitoring relief, the punitive damage relief is not limited to the four corners of each respective city or county. And so, therefore, that's a simple matter of reviewing those prayers for relief. If you look at the state's complaint, at the end of each cause of action, the state asks for actual damages, compensatory damages. It is not limited to prospective abatement relief. At the end of each cause of action, it is quite clear when they make the request then for actual compensatory damages. That's point one. But one of the things that I think that is important to look at is that through these 24 separate lawsuits, the injunctive relief that is being sought is not simply saying, oh, comply with existing law. It asks for relief that goes beyond existing law. And it claims that it should, that each one of these cities and counties should be entitled to injunctive relief that prohibits certain types of marketing of FDA-regulated medication. This private law firm, through 24 separate bites of the apple, they seek to reshape a highly regulated business conduct to surpass the balance of powers that have been set forth both at the state level as well as at the federal level. And so to suggest that somehow that these damages have been cabined, language then of the justice, is belied then by the record. Point number two, and that is this. Once again, the city seeks to bypass the very specific and unique definition that has been given to a matter of local concern. It seeks to suggest that somehow compensatory damages make this a matter of local concern. But that bypasses the definition that was given by the legislature. The legislature gave a very unique and a very specific definition of what was a matter of local concern. And so to suggest that somehow that the presumption applies to find power because it deals with a matter of local concern doesn't apply. Unless you first find that that unique, specifically defined definition of a matter of local concern applies, you don't get to that presumption. And instead, what you are left with is the first presumption that is found within the statute. And that first presumption states that unless that there's an express or an implied power, then it is presumed that that power does not exist. And if the power has been exercised, it is ultra vires and it is to be denied. The third point.
Ms. Lundvall, I apologize. I know you're trying to get to your four points, but doesn't that prove too much in terms of matters of local concern? I mean, isn't anything that a city deals with or regulates something that happens in other cities as well? You know, if they were trying to regulate graffiti or vandalism or anything else, certainly those are things that happen in cities other than the city of Reno. Does that mean nothing is a matter of local concern?
No, Your Honor, not at all. The statute has very three distinct subparts. Those distinct subparts have specific definitions. And those specific definitions then were to be demonstrated then by the city of Reno to prove that it was addressing only a matter of local concern. Subsection A spoke to the fact that if it was going to impact then residents outside of the four corners of that geographic area, then it was not a matter of local concern. If you look at their injunctive relief, their prospective relief, the punitive damages they seek, then in fact it is clearly outside the four corners of the city of Reno. Moreover, the district court made a finding that in fact that the litigation impacted and the subject matter of the litigation impacted those beyond the four corners of the city of Reno. Moreover, the district court also made a finding that subsection C then would apply. Subsection C is when the conduct that is at issue is substantially regulated by either state or federal agencies. In this circumstance, what you have is state regulation of pharmacies. What you have is federal regulation of prescription medications. The district court made that express finding, and so therefore subsection C cannot apply. And therefore the presumption that is being urged by the city of Reno cannot apply. And the last argument, let me see if I can't consolidate this. And that being this. It's not often that we brief an issue to this court for which that there has been no appellate review in any other jurisdiction. But in this particular case, that's what we're dealing with. It was suggested by counsel for the city of Reno that somehow that Dillon's rule had been looked at or examined by other appellate courts. That is not accurate. There's not a single appellate review by any other jurisdiction. Moreover, Dillon's rule is not technically the argument that is being made. It's the legislature that embraced Dillon's rule. It's the legislature that defined Dillon's rule. It's the legislature that stated how Dillon's rule was supposed to be applied in the state of Nevada. Each state has the opportunity to determine what powers and how those powers are going to be delegated to its subdivisions. The state of Nevada made those policy decisions. It reduced those policy decisions to a statute. And that statute is what is before the court. That statute has plain meaning to its language. It has simple language to be applied. And we urge this court to apply the plain meaning of that simple language to find that there is no express or implied or matter of local concern power that has been delegated. I suppose related to this last point, I would address then Justice Silver's point. There is multiple public nuisance cases that have been litigated across our state. But those fall within the specific parameters with procedural requirements that have been expressly authorized by our legislature. There is no general express authorization to bring a common law case, particularly one that addresses nuisance or negligence, to a city or to a state. And therefore, we would ask this court to apply the simple language that is found within the statute and to find that the city of Reno's case is ultra vires, and therefore it must be dismissed. With that, we submit, and we thank the court for the opportunity to present argument.
Do the justices have any questions for Ms. Lundvall?
No, sir.
All right, seeing none, once again, I'd like to express my appreciation to counsel and to for your excellent arguments today and your briefs in this case, and the matter will stand submitted. We will be in recess until 11:30 a.m. for the next oral argument case.